Hello and welcome to Beyond Reproach. This is Stephanie Domingo.
And Tux Lurzel.
We come to you from Bushwick, Brooklyn, where we record on land belonging to the Lenape Nation, a nation that is one of many, still very much out here doing its thing, and we'd like to acknowledge this. This is the show about scandals and scandalousness in American politics and government.
Show is.
Oh, we were having a tee-hee about The Simpsons prior to this.
Dr. Nick.
The incredible... incomparable Dr. Nick, an icon.
The B is for bargain.
Doctorb.
Yes, 1-800-DOCTORB.
Oh man, so good. We be drinking, we be swearing, y'all.
We sure fucking do. Today we are drinking a fancy ass punch called a fish house punch.
Yes, or, which sounds terrible.
Yes, it's also called Philadelphia fish house punch sometimes.
Is that better?
No.
Okay.
I was gonna make a joke about water.
Oh, we have a number of listeners from Philadelphia who will come for you in the night.
Is water a Philly thing or is it Pittsburgh? I know it's a Pennsylvania thing, but I'm not sure.
I thought
sure.
It was just Pennsylvania.
Oh, okay. Maybe it's both.
But I don't know.
Comment and let us know. Write in. Tell us. Like New Jersey. Do you say water? Well, you can make this punch with water. but today we made it with tea, because that was a very traditional thing to use to dilute a punch in the colonial era. We are drinking yet another colonial era cocktail today. I have mentioned this before multiple times, but a lot of the mixed drinks that we were drinking in those years were pretty basic, pretty simple, kind of boring. A lot of times they were just some kind of spirit mixed with some water. But that was really because the concept of the cocktail hadn't yet been invented. That didn't come till later. But we were drinking a lot of punch back in the 1700s. Punch was always served at any kind of like festive occasion. There was always a punch. But a lot of taverns and pubs would also have like a big bowl of punch that you paid, like, I don't know if you would pay per glass or how it worked, if you paid like when you came in and you could drink as much punch as you want. I don't know. But there was always punch all over the place. Especially in the Northeast, they were often rum punches because rum was such an important part of the colonial economy. Mm-hmm. They were usually flavored with some kind of citrus most of the time, and a lot of times they were often diluted with some kind of brewed tea. It could be a black tea, green tea, herbal tea, whatever, but they would use tea because it had more flavor than just plain water. I'm not going to stop. I think I've mentioned this before as well, but like when cocktails were finally invented in the 1800s, they were sort of originally thought up as like a single serving punch. It was like, this one's mine, so you can't have none. So today we are drinking one of the most famous punches in American history.
Oh, really?
Yeah, the Fish House Punch. This was invented at a private fishing and social club in Philadelphia. It was called the State in Schuylkill Fishing Corporation, but often known as the Fish House.
Okay.
They believed themselves to be like a sovereign, like, state.
Just this, like,
fishing house? Club. It was like a private men's club. Yeah.
Okay. Like, and as a sovereign state, what? So what?
I read something. I don't know. I didn't look into this, so I don't know if this is true.
Trying to get out of taxes type
thing? I read that they were exempt from prohibition.
Oh.
Because they were their own private state.
Yes. Yeah. Same is true for this apartment.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. So the club, the Philadelphia Fish House, was established in 1732. I don't know exactly when this punch was created, but rumor has it that George Washington drank some in 1787. He wrote in
his
diary. OG Dubs.
Okay.
Old OG.
Thank you.
He wrote in his diary that he was going to dine at the Fish House Club as an honored guest. And after he went to go as a guest there.
An honored guest.
Yes.
Oh, him.
Yes. After his visit, his diary remained uncharacteristically blank for the next 3 days.
That's amazing.
Yes.
He had himself a time.
Yes, exactly. Until 1900, the recipe for Fish House Punch was a closely guarded secret known only to the members of the club. It was made public in 1900, but even before that, it was still really well known across the country, legendary, because so many honored guests.
Yes.
And politicians would get to go as guests, and they would try it, and they would basically tell everyone they knew, yes, about the potency and flavor of this tasty-ass punch. David Wondrich wrote that the Philadelphia Fish House punch, quote, deserves to be protected by law, taught in the schools, and made a mandatory part of every 4th of July celebration.
I love that.
Yes.
Taught in schools.
Fish House punch.
Think about the children.
So there are some different variations on this punch. Even the Fish House has actually changed their recipes over the years because, you know, taste change. Sometimes people like something sweeter. You know, in certain decades and eras, people tend to like a sweeter drink versus a drier drink or whatever. So there are some different variations. Today we are drinking a version that is scaled down into basically a cocktail, an individual portion. It is made with rum, cognac, peach brandy, black tea, lemon juice, and a simple syrup infused with lemon peels. And of course, it is topped with grated nutmeg. Imagine that.
It sure is.
Yeah. So this drink would have been super fancy at the time. We're talking Jamaican rum, French cognac, peach brandy from the South, the very same peach brandy that Georgia said was essential to life and should be exempt from the distilling tax. We're talking British black tea that would have been originally from Asia.
Yeah, this drink has it all.
Yeah.
World-renowned,
yes. We're talking lemons and nutmeg, which were both expensive ingredients that sort of showed off how much money you had. Mm-hmm. So let's take a taste.
Yeah,
Fish
cheers.
House punch. Cheers.
Cheers. There we are. Mm.
When I was a kid at school learning the golden rule, teacher often used to say, if you don't tell a lie, there's not a reason why you can't be like Washington someday. How could Washington be a married man and never, never tell a lie?
Oh, that is delightful. I was a little afraid that the peach would be really sweet.
You can barely taste it, but you do get it at the end. Up front, it kind of tastes like a boozy Arnold Palmer.
Yeah.
Like a tea lemonade kind of a thing, but it's...
It doesn't taste very boozy.
It's...
But I saw all...
Yeah.
I saw you make this.
There's a lot of booze in this. There's like 3.5 ounces of booze per serving.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
Gird your loins.
I am scared to go second.
Yes. So when this is served, typically it would have been served in a punch bowl. You would do like an ice ring with lemons, like sliced lemons frozen into the ice ring.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. But you can also serve it warm in the winter months if you want like a mulled version. Typically, originally when this was made, it would have been made with something called oleosaccharum.
Yes, our old friend.
Yes. I have talked about oleosaccharum a little bit on the show. Basically, I was just saying that I hadn't made a punch yet because I didn't want to have to make oleosaccharum. In my mind, I thought that it was this thing that was like really complicated, took weeks to make, and involved fermenting. I lied. I was lying to myself and to you.
Thank you for coming clean.
Yes. I don't know where I got that. I don't know why I was making it more complicated than it actually is. I might have been looking at something else and got them mixed up. But
yeah, there's probably different recipes floating about in cocktail. I mean, I doubt you're on cocktail Reddit, but they're always doing the most.
Yeah. So essentially what oleosaccharum is, you would take lemon peels, peel just the yellow part, trying to avoid the white pith, peel the whole lemon, several of them, mm-hmm, several many lemons.
Yes.
Get all the peels together in a bowl and then muddle it up with white sugar.
Oh.
Muddle the lemon peels into sugar. And then you would just let it sit for like an hour, 2-3 hours, and the sugar will pull the citrus oils out of the lemon peel. And essentially at the end, what you're left with is a sweetened lemon oil. So that's what oleosaccharum is. Essentially, oleo means oil and saccharum means sugar.
Oh, okay.
So it's like an oily sugar or sugary lemon oil. Yeah.
Cool.
It doesn't last super long either. I don't know. In my head, I thought maybe it's a different way of making it where you do let it ferment so that it lasts longer or something. But don't quote me on that because I could be making that up. But I think it's supposed to last for like a couple weeks, maybe.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's not too bad.
Yeah. But so today, instead of doing all that, because I was making it on a smaller scale, I just peeled the lemons and infused the lemon peel in simple syrup.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. It's a very similar concept, but a little less labor intensive.
It tastes delicious.
It's super good, right?
It's really, really good.
I love an Arnold Palmer in the summer, so yeah. it tastes just like that.
Very summery.
Like if you made an Arnold Palmer with that like peachy tea.
Yeah.
That's what it would taste like.
Yeah.
But also boozy. And there's lots of different kinds of black tea too. That's true. There's like the peachy kind, there's orange pico and Earl Grey and all sorts of stuff that you could be doing.
I love that you just discovered that Earl Grey smells like Fruit Loops.
Yeah, I love Earl Grey, and I never...
So Tux got, it was a Earl Grey cookie, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you're just like, oh, it tastes like Fruit Loops. And I'm like,
no,
yeah.
No, it was a bergamot cookie.
Oh, bergamot.
Yeah.
Okay. For me, Earl Grey has always smelled like Fruit Loops.
That's funny. Yeah. Yeah, it was a bergamot cookie. And I was like, why does this straight up just taste like Fruit Loops? It was the bergamot. Who knew?
Everyone but you.
Yep. True story. So... I don't know what's going on this season, but we have been talking about colonial America and the founding fathers a whole bunch this season. I feel like this, we've sort of talked a little bit before, but this is the first time we've ever really done like deep dives on.
Yeah, I did John Adams and Teach.
Yes.
When they were doing all of the misinformation.
Yeah. Is, what's his name? Trump's favorite.
Oh.
Andrew Jackson. Is he a founding father?
No.
Yeah. Okay.
He's
trash.
Yeah,
he's later. Yeah. that's different.
No.
I feel like some people would lump him in with founding fathers, even though he wasn't really founding.
Yeah.
But he's like one of those famous ones, you know? Like
he absolutely
he's
is.
He's on money, so yeah. People think it's the same thing.
He did a lot.
Yeah. He's the worst.
Fucked up shit.
Yeah, exactly.
And yeah, ugh.
Yeah.
He's the fucking worst.
He is the worst. At any rate, that doesn't stop today. For whatever reason, we keep talking about these founding fathers, and that
keep
does
it
not
going.
Stop today. But I'm not going to be talking about Teej.
Yes,
I'm not
good.
Talking about OG Dubs. I'm not even talking about old Benny Frank.
Ha!
And I'm not even talking about your favorite.
Alexander Hamilton.
Instead, today I'm going to be talking about a really, really important founding father that most people have never even heard of.
Wait, I thought you were talking about Hamilton.
No. He comes up
you guys,
a little
I
bit.
Was lied to.
Yes, he comes
I'm
up.
I'm busy.
All of these people will come up a little bit. I will mention all of these names again, but he's not the topic today.
I was sold a bill of goods.
Despite having written the famous words, "We the people of the United States," Gouverneur Morris has been largely left out of American history. He kept very detailed diaries during his life, so it's not because we don't know much about him. Maybe it's because his name is too hard to pronounce. It's like a French spelling. It's G-O-U-V-E-R-N-E-U-R, Gouverneur.
Oh, he's Gouverneur. Not just a governor?
No, that's his name, Gouverneur.
Okay.
Yeah, Gouverneur Morris is his name. So maybe that's why he's been left out of history, because his name is too hard to pronounce. Maybe it's because he's one of the youngest founding fathers.
Oh, okay.
Maybe it was because he was vocally opposed to slavery,
uh-oh,
the French Revolution, and the War of 1812.
Damn.
All of which made him really unpopular with his colleagues.
These kids these days.
I know. Shake harder, boy. Or maybe it's because he just doesn't fit the mold of what people think a founding father is supposed to be. Gouverneur Morris was handsome, successful, immodest, outspoken,
ooh,
funny, witty, and loved to gossip.
Oh, I love him.
Yes.
Okay.
He sounds like the kind of person I want to hang out
yeah
with. He's my founding father.
Totally.
He kept some really, really detailed diaries throughout his life, and those diaries reveal way too much about him and the lurid, scandalous, and sexy life that he led.
I love this story
yes
already.
He was well known for his sexual appetites and public affairs,
ooh,
the most notorious of which happened in the Louvre.
Okay.
Yes.
I see you, Gouverneur.
Yes. Later in life, he married a notorious, infamous woman who was over 2 decades younger than him.
Damn.
And oh yeah, he had a peg leg.
What?
Yes. He also happened to have a peg leg.
Wait, this whole, he had a peg
the
leg?
The whole time?
The whole time, though?
The whole time.
He
was a very sexy peg leg.
He was a founding father with a peg leg?
Uh-huh.
That's amazing.
Yes.
So we had a disabled, like, founding father.
Yeah, yeah. So I would like to propose a toast. Raise a glass.
Yeah.
To getting jiggy with it.
No.
Na 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 na. Na 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 na.
No. I hate you for that so much. That's, wow. I want to drink this cocktail, but do I want to drink it to getting jiggy with it? I don't know.
I thought you were going to say, I want to drink this cocktail, but I also want to throw it in your face.
No. That was such a good toast.
Finally, man. I win.
How do you compete with getting jiggy with it? Damn, the bar has been raised.
See? This is like the contest of the toast one-upsmanship. I've ever since
you've set the bar.
Ever since toasting to you gotta make money. What was it?
Oh, you gotta
print money to make money.
Print money to make money. Yes. Like,
how can I outdo that?
Well, yeah,
getting jiggy with it.
You did. You did. I salute you.
Yeah, thank you. So today I'm going to be talking about him. This isn't necessarily like a scandal. It's just sort of
he sounds his like scandal. A scandal.
He is a scandal. That's,
yeah.
Today's story is sort of his scandalous life because nobody really has ever heard of him. So Gouverneur Morris was born in 1752, the youngest son of a wealthy landowning New York family from what is now known as the Bronx.
Okay.
They had like a 2,000-acre estate in the Bronx called Morrisania.
Holy shit.
Yeah. His first name comes from his mother's maiden name, which in Dutch and French means governor.
Mm.
But it's gouverneur. This came up in my research in one of the articles I read. It let me know. You might be shocked by this. Brace yourself. According to babynamespedia.com, today, quote, gouverneur is not popular as a baby name for boys.
I'm going to have to check that site to make sure. So shocking.
Despite the fact that his family, most of his family were British loyalists, he supported the American Revolution and worked for New York's revolutionary government. He was also the youngest person to sign the Articles of Confederation in 1778.
How old was he?
I don't see how that's any of your business.
Oh, you're right. I'm being fucking nosy and I need to mind my business. What kind of New Yorker am I asking questions? I sound like the cops. I
know. Oh my God. Amazing. So during the Revolutionary War, he became really close personal friends with several other founding fathers. And he had especially close relationships with George Washington, OG Dubs, and
Alexander Hamilton.
So his work for the Revolution kept him really, really busy during those years. But it wasn't so busy that he couldn't maintain his reputation as a ladies' man.
Are you going to get into what happened to his leg?
Right now.
Okay, because I'm like, yes. I need to know this right now. Yes. Thank you.
So in the year 1780, he lost his left leg at age 32. It was not because of the war. It was because he was hit by a carriage in the streets of Philadelphia.
Oh, shit.
There are a few stories about how and why this happened, but I read some different accounts. But several historians have repeated this story that he was running through the streets of Philadelphia trying to escape the husband of a woman that he'd been sleeping with.
That's hilarious.
Wasn't looking where he was going and ran in front of a carriage.
Okay.
There were also several rumors that swirled at the time that he had actually injured his leg jumping from the balcony of a woman's bedroom when her husband came home and caught them together.
Wow.
Yes. But there is documentation of the intersection where this accident happened, so it's more likely that it was the carriage accident.
Okay.
Whether or not he was actually running from a man, you know, we're not positive, but I saw that story repeated multiple times.
It's like it sounds like him.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Either way, no matter what happened, his left ankle was mangled, and he had several broken bones in his left leg, which had to be amputated below the knee, so then he had a peg leg for the rest of his life. But he didn't let that bother him. He kept right on riding horses.
Yeah, he's like, my penis is fine.
Yeah, you know? Exactly. Yeah.
I got this.
He's riding horses, dancing, sailing, playing sports, all with his peg leg. And he also didn't let it stop him from getting himself into trouble with married women and their husbands.
I love that for him.
Yes. A really good friend of his named John Jay later wrote that he wished he had, quote, had lost something else.
John Jay's a hater.
Because he was always getting himself into trouble with that something else.
Yes.
In 1787, when the Constitutional Convention met in Philadelphia, he was one of the youngest and yet most important delegates there. He served on multiple committees and gave more speeches at the Constitutional Convention than anyone else.
Really?
173 speeches.
What?
Yes. Several of those speeches were arguing for religious freedom and the abolition of slavery, which he called a nefarious institution. Some historians say that one of his arguments against slavery was one of the most eloquent speeches given at this convention. Mm. He said that slavery was a curse on the states where it prevailed and would only bring misery and poverty to anyone involved. He also said that slavery was against the entire purpose of the Constitution, which in his mind, he believed was to protect the rights of humanity. Yeah.
Yeah, he's not wrong.
He was also vehemently against the Three-Fifths Compromise, and he said that it was a contradiction to say that an enslaved person was both a man and property at the same time.
Look at this man with all the facts.
I know. Upon what principle is it that the slaves shall be computed in the representation? Are they men? Then make them citizens and let them vote. Are they property? Why, then, is no other property included?
Damn.
You don't get a Two-Fifths Compromise for your oxen. You know what I mean? Like,
because racism.
Yeah. I know. Yeah. So this obviously pissed a whole bunch of people off, especially like, people from the South.
He's making us look like the hypocrites that we are.
Yes. Yeah.
We stand for freedom and justice for all.
White men.
Yes. Landowning white
men. Yes, exactly. But when it comes to that landowning thing, he may sound like a hero with the slavery thing, but he was also not great. His politics were a little questionable, at least by today's standards.
Yeah.
He was a staunch Federalist. He was unapologetically aristocratic and super classist. He sometimes referred to the poor.
His name is Governor.
Yeah, exactly. Like, yes. He sometimes referred to the poor as reptiles.
What?
Yes. And at one point he tried to argue that only rich people should be allowed to vote because, quote, give the votes to people who have no property and they will sell them to the rich who will be able to buy them. Now, you could argue that today votes are for sale.
Yeah. I'm like, that's a true statement. Yeah,
basically, whoever has the most money to spend on their campaigns is the one who wins. So he's not wrong.
Yeah.
But the intentions there and, like, the thoughts behind it were just a little too... His nose was up in the air, you know?
Yeah.
He's cool, but he's not, you know, not great.
No.
Good, not great.
He has some great ideas, but he also is a problem.
Yes, exactly. He was also super sexy.
Yeah, he's young, too.
Yeah, totally, yeah. And he was also famously good with words. He was a really accomplished writer. Mm. And he was so famously good with words that he was actually appointed to the Constitutional Convention's Committee of Style.
Ooh.
And he was asked to polish the wording of the Constitution. James Madison later wrote, "The finish given to the style and arrangement of the Constitution fairly belongs to the pen of Mr. Morris. A better choice could not have been made."
Wow.
Perhaps his biggest contribution to the Constitution was to scrap and completely rewrite the entire preamble, which originally read, "We the people of the states of New Hampshire, Massachusetts, Rhode Island, and Providence plantations, Connecticut, New York, New Jersey, Pennsylvania, Delaware, Maryland, Virginia, North Carolina, South Carolina, and Georgia, do ordain, declare, and establish the following constitution for the government of ourselves and our posterity."
Mm.
Which he thought was like, A, that's way too long.
That's way too long.
Yeah. But B, he thought that the focus should be on one unified nation and not just a collection of states.
Yeah.
So he changed it to...
What was the one plantation?
Providence Plantations.
Providence is a bad place.
Yeah. So he changed it to "We the people of the United States" in order to form a more perfect union.
Mm, okay.
It's a much better ring to it.
Yes.
In 1788, once the new government was basically like up and running, things were going well, he got out of Dodge. At age 36, he moved to France, which was in the middle of their own revolution at the time. He went there originally on business. He had some... like property he was trying to sell or something.
Mm-hmm.
But once he got there, Washington decided to make him the U.S. ambassador to France. So he stayed there for the better part of the French Revolution. He was there for like 5 years.
Thomas Jefferson, I think, had that role for a moment.
Oh, did he? Yeah. There are some key differences between him and Jefferson. We'll get into that in a little bit.
Sure.
So he kept these really, really detailed diaries while he was in France. And the stuff that I have read about this man and his life that he led while he was in France, I obviously I can't get into all of it today. It's fascinating, though. If you guys enjoy this story and you want to hear more about Gouverneur Morris, please look him up, because the stuff that was going on while he was in France is incredible. He was such an interesting... He's a super weird dude.
Yeah.
But like, wow, what a life. He's worth looking into. But basically, the bottom line here is that before the revolution turned really bloody, he was running in the same social circles as the French bourgeoisie. He was hanging out in the palaces of the monarchy, hanging out all with all these sort of lower, like, counts and, you know what I mean? And it seems like a big part of the fun for him, at least at first before things got really dangerous, a big part of the fun was that European court society had different views on marriage than Americans did, basically saw the boundaries of marriage as fluid, and he was there to take full advantage. Yeah, he's like,
yes,
please.
They're still like that.
Yeah.
Lucky bastards.
So he was having all of the sex while he was in France. But the thing that actually really set him apart from a lot of the other men who were his sort of like contemporaries at this time is that he actually like really enjoyed talking to women and hanging out with women, not just for sex. Like he actually saw women as people.
What?
I know. Which like at the time was significant. Like people did not, or men.
Or even now.
Yeah, I know. Seriously. Yeah.
What? At the time.
Yeah. He would have these like deep, serious conversations with many of the women he met while he was in France. And in his diary, he gave them full credit for being insightful, intelligent, witty, and being perceptive political thinkers, which like they weren't even really allowed to talk about politics a lot of the time. You know, that while that was all happening, he also was having plenty of sex. So let's get back to the sex, because that's the fun part, obviously. So his most famous affair was with the 28-year-old novelist Comtesse Adelaide de Flahaute, who was married to a count who was 35 years older than her, the 63-year-old Alexandre Sébastien de Flahaute de la Billardrie.
Ooh.
Yes.
Beautiful.
When Morris first met her, Madame Flahaute was living in her apartments inside the Louvre. Which was, at the time, still a palace for the French monarchy and not an art museum yet.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, that was Louis XVI's, like, palace.
I mean, that makes sense, because it's ginormous.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, it was built as a as a palace for the king.
Of course it was.
And then Versailles was, like, their summer home.
Yeah.
But that's, like, they weren't always at Versailles. It was just, the Louvre was, like, their main place, you know? So, she was living, she had apartments in the, well, it was... Her husband, Alexandre Sébastien de Flahaute de la Billardrie, had these apartments in the Louvre. And,
what a name.
I know. So
I
he was
17 names.
I know, right? Everyone has a million names. I feel like the richer you were, the more names you got. So Gouverneur Morris's diary is filled with all of these entries talking about going to the Louvre to see Madame Flahaute to, quote, do the needful or, quote, celebrate.
I do the needful.
Yes.
That's so good.
These were his two favorite euphemisms for sex in his diaries.
Celebrate.
Yes.
I do.
Celebrate.
That's pretty good as well.
He was celebrating all over Paris.
Yeah.
He and him and Madame Flahaute. It turns out, or it looks like they really, really liked the thrill of public sex and the, and the possibility of getting caught. They once had sex in a convent.
Whoa.
And there's one diary entry that he writes that they were celebrating in the hallway of the Louvre while someone was in the next room playing an instrument and his husband or her husband was in the apartment downstairs. And there were like just people coming like through the halls. They had
Living
all the doors
on the
open.
Edge,
yeah.
I love that.
He wrote, quote, go to the Louvre. We take the chance of interruption and celebrate in the passage while Mademoiselle is playing at the harpsichord in the drawing room. The husband is below. Visitors are hourly expected. The doors are all open.
Wow.
With a peg leg.
Clearly he was fine in other ways.
Yeah, exactly. So Madame Flahaute was definitely not the only woman that he was sleeping with at this time. He mentions in his diaries.
Celebrating with.
Celebrating, yes. He was doing the needful with many, many other women, including Madame Flahaut's own niece.
What?
Yes.
No.
But she was also seeing other men at the same time.
Yeah, well, it's, yeah.
She France. Was, yeah. What would be the masculine version of a mistress? A mister? She had lots of a other lover. Misters. Yes. Lovers. So her most familiar lover was a French diplomat named Charles Maurice de Talleyrand-Périgord.
Ooh, he sounds wealthy.
Yes. He is actually the father to Madame Flahaut's only son, even though she was married to someone else.
Okay.
He later became Napoleon's foreign minister and actually sold the Louisiana Purchase to the United States.
What? Yes. Wow. Okay.
Everyone was just having themselves a time at this point.
It's France.
Yeah.
It's what you do.
Yeah.
I love
especially,
it.
Especially, yeah, at this point during the revolution, the bourgeoisie was having too good of a time, which is basically what caused the revolution, you know?
Yeah.
But yeah, the fun couldn't last forever. On that note, I think it might be time to take a little break.
Yes.
Get some more jaw juice.
You're like the tin man that...
Oil can. Fish house bun.
What was that, tin man?
BRB.
Hey, this is Brandon from Peculiar Picture Show, the podcast that talks about movies, maladies, and mental health.
And this is Maria, also from that podcast.
So we were wondering, do you like movies? Do you like mental health?
Oh boy, do I ever, Brandon.
Well then, I've got a podcast for you. Peculiar Picture Show is the podcast for you because it is about movies and mental health.
That's right. We use movies to talk about mental health issues like borderline personality disorder, social issues like systemic racism, and other things.
Like how bad Shakespeare in Love was.
Yeah, sometimes we just talk about how bad the movie is.
And we really talked about that one. But sometimes we have games. Maria used to be a teacher, and so she loves to quiz people.
I really do.
So check us out online at peculiarpicture.show. That's our website, and you can stream all episodes there.
Or you can find us on any major podcast channel.
All right.
So good.
It's so good.
Mm. So peachy.
I need more. So... everyone was having themselves a time, but eventually the French Revolution, you know, as time went on, became more dangerous, more violent.
Less sexy?
Yes, exactly. Mm. Maurice was, quote, the only foreign representative who remained in his post throughout the worst days of the terror.
Hmm.
He was there through, like the thick of it. I read two different accounts of him having to use his peg leg to save his own life.
Oh, wow.
One historian wrote that he was riding around in like a fancy carriage, like a, you know, like a rich person's carriage that caught the attention of some rioters or whatever. He was riding in this carriage with a lady friend.
I'm shocked by this.
When a mob surrounded the carriage and he pulled off his leg and shoved it out the window shouting, "Vive la Révolution!" Which distracted people long enough that the carriage could run away.
That's hilarious.
Like, what? That's a leg? What the fuck? Somebody's leg is sticking out the window? What's happening?
So what was a peg leg like back then?
I think it was just like a, like what you're thinking, like a
like
pirate.
A pirate?
Yeah.
Like just like the
I
little
think it's
posts?
Just like a stick. I mean, maybe it was more leg-shaped.
Yeah.
Probably, it was probably more leg-shaped
I think
at
it
that
probably
point.
Was, yeah.
It was sort of like strapped on at somehow. I'm not sure. But I read another story that Maurice, quote, found himself at the center of a hostile mob in favor of hanging him on the nearest lamppost. He unfastened his wooden leg, brandished it above his head, and proclaimed himself an American who had lost his limb fighting for liberty. Which is a lie.
I love him so much.
At which point the mob, quote, the mob's suspicions melted into enthusiastic cheers. This guy's all right. Yeah. What a guy, right?
He was so like quick on his feet.
Yeah, totally.
On his one leg.
On his one foot, yeah.
Didn't even need 2 feet to be quick. A legend.
Yeah, that's funny. I took this out of my outline, but there was a quote that he wrote that he had so little trouble missing a leg that he might as well just get rid of the other one too. Like, he was making jokes with his friends.
I mean, yeah.
Yeah. So he was in Paris for 5 years, and he saw, during this time, he saw some of the bloodiest violence of the French Revolution firsthand.
Whoa.
In July 1789, he wrote in his diary, "After dinner, walk a little under the arcade of the Palais Royal, waiting for my carriage. In this period, the head and body of Monsieur de Foulon are introduced in triumph. The head on a pike, the body dragged naked on the earth. What? Afterwards, this horrible exhibition is carried through the different streets. Gracious God, what a people." And yeah. These kinds of entries were pretty rare in his diary at first, but as time went on, they became more and more common.
French really didn't give a fuck.
They were living in a really oppressive society where, like, oppressive. They had no money because Louis the 16th had all of, he was the Jeff Bezos of, you know what I mean?
And they rose up and they really did shit.
Exactly. He was launching dicks into space in France in the 1700s. Yeah. And the French were like, no, motherfucker, that's our money.
So do you know who Desus and Mero are?
I know of them, but okay. I haven't seen.
They're two Bronx born podcasters. They now have a show on Showtime. They have a podcast called The Bodega Boys, and one of the hosts is from the Dominican Republic. The other one is Haitian.
Mm-hmm.
And the one from the Dominican Republic was saying that his father was always saying, because the DR was so fucked up by just colonialism.
Sure, yeah.
And there were so many uprisings. But, like, once he moved to this country, he's like, yeah, these people are too comfortable to ever have a revolution.
Well, that's the whole thing. We have our phones. Oh. We have all of our, they.
Yeah. And he said this in the 70s.
Yeah. They before smartphones. They know exactly what they're doing to keep us placated, you know.
It made me really sad when I heard that. I'm like, oh.
It was at a point where, like, people couldn't afford to eat.
Yeah. It was a different set of circumstances.
Totally. But we're, you know, things are getting worse and worse every year in this country. So we might not be that too far off. We'll see.
Yeah.
Eventually, things become, you know, scary enough, dangerous enough that Governor gave money to Madame Flahaut so that she could get some fake passports so that she could get herself and her son out to London. They fled to London. Unfortunately, her husband went to the guillotine, Madame Flahaut's husband.
Shit.
Morris used bribes and the power of his office to try to save several nobles and intellectuals to try and help them escape the guillotine.
It's sometimes weird that they all worked. Stayed in the palace, though.
I know.
Like,
yeah.
It's a sinking ship. They're going to get you.
I mean, much like a sinking ship, a lot of people didn't want to believe that it was sinking. You know what I mean? People didn't want to believe until it was too late.
But you're seeing your friends dragged in the street.
Yeah.
Naked and, like, their head put on pikes.
Yeah.
I would think it would be hard to get over that sort of sight.
I mean,
when you have money and influence, like, just bitch be gone. Like, yeah, go.
I know.
Go right, anywhere. Yeah,
I'm sure
you
that some people
have all of
fled.
The money.
I'm sure that a lot of people did flee, but I think at the same time, it was sort of a situation where, like, people are really good at lying to themselves. Look at, like, COVID. You know what I mean? People are like, I couldn't die because I'm healthy. I'm this. I'm not obese.
I take Joe Rogan's vitamins.
Exactly. Yeah. So they all had reasons in their heads that, like, this only happened to that guy because he was doing the wrong thing. But I'm not doing anything wrong, so I'm fine.
You can rationalize anything.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. That's true. I'm by no means an expert on the French Revolution at all, but I'm just kind of assuming, like, why people wouldn't leave.
Yeah.
I'm sure some people did, but most of them,
like,
a lot
I understand
of them did not.
Being in the war-torn place and you want to leave and you have no funds, but these people have all the funds.
Yeah. I mean, some people left and then were, like, arrested by other governments because France was also at war with, like, Austria. What's his name? Lafayette ended up becoming a prisoner of war when he tried to flee France. Like, there's
the Marquis de Lafayette?
Yeah.
Hmm.
And then Governor Morris actually tried to, like, save him, went to Austria after he was in France. He went, I took this out of my outline because I'm like, my outline's too long.
Yeah.
But yeah, he went to Austria and, like, pled with the king to release the Marquis de Lafayette because he had come to help the colonies in the States. So there were reasons why people couldn't leave France too, you know?
Okay.
It's funny with Europe. Europe is so small compared to the United States. But these are all different countries. It's not as easy to just go, you know what I mean? As like going to Pennsylvania.
It's not like they could, you know, fly.
Exactly.
There was no, like, easy jet.
Yeah, totally.
For them. I mean, you know, they're too rich for that. But, like, yeah, you can't fly. You have...
Get your carriages and all your trunks and everything together.
Oh, leave that shit behind. Leave that shit behind.
Yeah, but I mean, people have like estates and it's all sort of like, it's all on paper. If you can't just show up somewhere and be like, I'm rich. I'm like, well, where's your money?
Yeah, that's why that's a problem.
Yeah, exactly.
It's like you really don't have anything.
Yeah.
What you have is like influence.
Exactly.
And, estates.
Well, and I think that's like people just thought, it's not going to get that bad.
Mm.
Things are a little rough, but it'll get better.
Yeah.
And I don't want to leave all of this.
Yeah, I understand the fear. And things, especially if it's like, it doesn't feel that bad.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, eventually it did get really bad. And by then, I think a lot of people did.
It's like the boiled lobster sort of thing.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. Frogs.
Frogs? I thought it was lobster.
I think it's frogs.
Okay.
I mean, it doesn't matter. Some kind of animal in hot water.
Yeah.
But anyways.
Some sort of animal murder.
Yes, exactly. Slow, comfortable death. It's a hot tub. It just gets a little too hot.
Just tad. Smidge.
Yeah. So he did his influence, you know, between his office and the bribes that he was able to make. He did have some influence and helped some people escape and escape the guillotine. But sometimes it didn't work, and he was literally watching in horror as his friends' heads were cut off, mounted on pikes, and paraded through the streets. Ugh. He saw this happen.
Dark.
Unlike Thomas Jefferson, old Tiege.
Tiege is a wimp.
Yeah. He, Morris.
He's like, I want to live. Bye.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. But Governor Morris was also really critical of the French Revolution while he was there, while it was unfolding. He was like vocally opposed to it as the French foreign minister. And he was also really sympathetic to Marie Antoinette, way more than the king. For some reason, he had this idea that, like, because she was a woman and she wasn't really allowed to do things, that she was sort of off limits somehow.
Mm.
But so because of this, after 5 years in Paris, the new French government was like, get the fuck out of here. You're not, you don't support us.
You're down with the aristocracy.
Exactly.
Like, we don't need you here.
Exactly.
That time is over.
Yeah. So after 5 years in Paris, they booted him from France. And he went all over Europe after this, though. He went to Vienna to try and help the Marquis de Lafayette.
Yeah.
He went to London. He went to Berlin. He was all over the place. And everywhere he went, he was dicking down bitches. All over the world.
It's one of Tux's favorite things to say.
Never. Never say that. Don't you lie to people. Sick and dumb bitches. Oh my god. I was like, am I writing this right now? I'm writing dick and dumb bitches.
This is something that Tux was agonizing over. Yeah. He's like, people are gonna think I'm this way. I'm like, you are an old woman. What are you talking about?
Now I just sound like an old woman trying to sound like a young man.
Yes.
But yeah, so he went all over Europe. Eventually, though, he did go back to New York in 1798. He moved back to the States. Years before, like before he even left, he said that he never wanted to run for elected office. He wanted to basically like help the government set itself up, but didn't really want to be a part of it exactly. Mm-hmm. But once he got back to the States, his good Judy.
Oh, that's his good Judy.
Yeah.
Alexander Hamilton. Of course they're friends.
Yeah. So Hamilton basically pressured him and convinced him to run for Congress. And in the year 1800, he was elected senator of the state of New York.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. He was really, really close with Hamilton. He, according to one historian, one of the most poignant entries in his diary was the day he was sitting with
Alexander Hamilton.
As he lay dying after his duel with Aaron Burr, Morris was devastated by Hamilton's death and he broke down at the funeral while he was delivering the eulogy.
Oh no.
Some historians even kind of suggest that they may have had a romantic relationship, these two men, or at least a sort of a flirtation.
Mm.
Several historians do believe that there's evidence that Hamilton may have been bisexual. And after analyzing the letters between Hamilton and Morris.
I've also heard that.
Yeah. It does appear that in their letters together, there was some sort of like playful, open flirtation. Yeah.
Affection.
Yeah. There's plenty of references to one another's sex lives and their affections for one another. People wrote differently. People used language differently back then. So these letters are sort of open to our interpretation. So I don't really want to spend a ton of time talking about like how the letters could be interpreted. I'm just kind of leave it at that and say, like, it's possible. We don't know for sure.
It was a long time ago.
Exactly.
It's hard to know.
Yeah. if you are interested in the possibility that
Alexander Hamilton
may have been bisexual, a quick Google search will turn up a wealth of information.
Yes.
On all of the letters that he had with some very close male friends, much closer than Governor Morris. And these letters are filled with these like sappy, like sticky, gooey, like declarations of love.
Yeah.
Filled with plenty of sexual innuendo and like all these references to affection.
Are you talking about Lawrence?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I'm just going to leave it there. I may end up revisiting this.
Please do.
Yeah. It may be in a mini-sode sometime soon. We'll see. Maybe. But whether or not Governor Morris and Hamilton had a romantic relationship or not, they did have a very strong personal friendship.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that he was there in Hamilton's last moments and that he wrote his eulogy just goes to show you how close they were to each other and how much they meant to each other. But so for years, Governor Morris had never settled down. He preferred instead to spend his time romancing other men's wives, romancing married women. But then,
well, they're probably so grateful.
Yeah, absolutely.
Like,
yeah.
I get that.
Yeah. But then in 1809, he shocked everyone when, at the age of 57, he married the disgraced black sheep of an aristocratic family who happened to be his 35-year-old housekeeper.
You can't hear my mouth open. His housekeeper. Yes, okay. Yeah.
Anne Carey Randolph.
Married.
Yes, exactly.
Huh.
Anne Carey Randolph, who went by the name of Nancy, had a reputation dating back to 1792. She came from a very well-respected and powerful Virginia family, but when she was 17, she was accused of sleeping with her sister's husband, Richard. A baby was born, but died shortly after birth, and Nancy and Richard were both accused of murdering the baby. They were tried for murder. Both of them were acquitted, but then shortly afterwards, Richard suddenly died a few years later. And then after Richard's death, both Nancy and her sister were considered suspects in Richard's death.
Okay, so not every death is a fucking murder, you guys.
Yeah. Of course, there was no proof, nothing came of it, but then after this, her family disowned her.
Okay.
You are just one scandal after another. We don't want you around. So penniless and in disgrace, she moved north looking for work, and Governor didn't really seem to mind her reputation. He may have even hired her because of it, because he loved scandal and
mess. He loved mess.
She also was really good looking.
She's beautiful, clearly.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. He also certainly loved the scandal it caused when he shocked his Christmas party guests.
What a messy bitch.
I know.
Wow.
Yes. In 1809.
It has come to my attention.
Yes, it's recently come to my attention that I'm getting married.
Okay.
So yeah, at his Christmas party in 1809, he had a surprise wedding to Nancy.
Wait, what?
No one knew that he was getting married that day. His guest showed up and he was like, oh yeah, by the way, I know it's Christmas, but I'm getting married to Nancy, who is also 22 years younger than me, by the way. And all of his guests were like, what? He wrote in his diary, I marry this day Anne Carey Randolph. No small surprise to my guests.
Wow. This man, even with his diary, he's like telling jokes like being like, tee.
He's so good.
Yeah.
So 3 years later, they had their only child, Governor Morris Jr. I'm not 100% sure that he was faithful to Nancy, but I do know that he...
He fathered a child at 56?
Yeah. She was, what did I say,
36 or something?
Yeah. But yeah, they had one son. But they really did love each other, it appears, from
how long did evidence. She work for him?
Not for very long. I think she showed up and he was like, oh.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Of course he was.
Yeah. And he's getting a little older by this point. So he's like, okay, I guess it's time.
Yeah.
And this hot lady is like, not going to turn me down because her family has like cast her out.
She needs me.
Yeah, exactly. But they did.
And I need her.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. They had a really, really close, like super loving relationship. Aww. There's all these stories about like love letters that they wrote. And like,
Okay.
But then, unfortunately, in 1814, an angry cousin of Nancy's from the South who, like, was still pissed off about everything that had happened
before. Oh, she's from the South?
Yeah, she's from Virginia.
Okay, yeah, that is the South.
Yeah. It's like the north of the south, but
it's southern
enough. Yeah, exactly. They say y'all. So this cousin started spreading rumors about her, saying that, well, among other things, saying that Nancy had poisoned visitors to their estate. They had a dinner and like that she poisoned the guests at their dinner, and that her son...
What would be the point of that, though?
Because he was pissed about everything that had happened when she lived in the south, that like the death of the baby and the death of her sister's husband. So he was just trying to stir up the pot. He was pissed. And
okay. He's not good at lying, though.
No, not at all. Because, okay, like, nobody died. Like, what are you talking about? Yeah.
Show us the bodies, these poisoned guests, sir.
Yeah. Yeah. And, but
and it's like guest plural. Like, exactly. Come on.
Yeah. He also was trying to say that her son was by somebody else, that she was sleeping around. It's like, you don't have any proof of that. Shut up. But it worked. It kind of
really?
Like, after this, like, most of Morris's family and a lot of his friends stopped coming to their house, stopped visiting them. Their home was suddenly like, they had like this big estate. He loved entertaining. He loved having parties. And like, suddenly it was empty. It was like no one was coming over anymore. Mm-hmm. He was really bummed about it. It was really upsetting to both of them. But by this point, he was busy turning New York into a global powerhouse. In 1807, he was appointed to the commission that planned New York City's iconic grid system.
What?
He was in charge of the grid system.
Is he like a city planner?
Well, he was
planner?
The senator of New York State at that point. So he was also appointed a chairman of the Erie Canal Commission.
They're just giving jobs to rich people or something?
But he was like really in like important on these commissions and like made some really big
decisions.
But what
does he know about the like...
He was the one, or one of the people, who decided that the Hudson River should be connected by canal to Lake Erie rather than just Lake Ontario. So that meant, like, because of him and probably some other people, but it was partially his decision to basically have access to all of the Great Lakes and not just Lake Ontario. Mm-hmm. Because there's, between Lake Ontario and Lake Erie, there's Niagara Falls.
Yeah.
So you can't go between those two lakes. Mm-mm. But once you get into
Lake Erie, yes,
you can go to all the other lakes and you have access to the entire Midwest because of that. That was his decision. It's a longer route. It was more expensive.
Yeah.
But it opened up New York City trade to the entire Midwest.
Yeah. Chicago.
Yeah.
Detroit.
Exactly. Yeah. So it was a big deal that he was on this commission and this happened because of him. Mm-hmm. And he, like, the grid system was partially his idea too. They just were tasked with like trying to figure out how to deal with New York's expansion. Mm-hmm. But the grid system came sort of because of, not just because of him, but like there were plenty of other ways that they could have done it. But they were like, you know what? It's going to be cheaper to build straight square buildings. It's going to be more efficient, faster, and cheaper. Let's do a grid. He was on these commissions and he made some like actually really great decisions that basically made New York State the state it is today.
Oh, that's
New York
awesome.
City, the city it is today. Hmm. His final public act as a politician was vocally opposing American participation in the War of 1812.
Ooh.
Because he believed it was idiotic, unwinnable, and could be disastrous for the economy of the Northeast. He also believed that it was a plot among slaveholding states to try to conquer Canada to expand their territory northward. Because of this, he was so sure that it was such a terrible idea to get involved in the War of 1812 that he pushed for New York and New England to secede from the country.
Yes, I do know a little bit about this. Yeah.
In the words of his biographer, quote, "The man who wrote the Constitution judged it to be a failure and was willing to scrap it."
Yep.
So he's getting older. By this point, he's suffering from gout, pretty bad.
Of course
gout.
He is.
Yes, yeah. And probably he had some symptoms that were probably related to some STIs that he may or may not have had.
Yeah.
Yeah. So in 1816, he had a painful urinary tract blockage.
Ooh, yikes.
And he decided to take matters into his own hands.
What? No.
Tried to clear it himself using a piece of whale bone as a catheter.
Okay, give me a moment. I'm going to send my spirit elsewhere.
Yes. So just in case anyone at home listening wasn't sure if sticking a piece of whalebone up your dick is a good idea or not, it's not. It's not a good idea. It is, in fact, a really bad idea. Do not stick a piece of whalebone up your dick.
He died because of his wounds?
Yes,
of course he did
not clear the blockage from his urethra, but he did cause some pretty nasty internal injuries that got infected. and he passed away on November 6, 1816, at the age of 64. Days after he died, a Boston newspaper wrote that he had died from, quote, a short but distressing illness.
How dare they? That is rude.
Today, scholars believe that he probably had prostate cancer.
Oh.
And that's probably what was going on.
Oh, okay, yeah.
So that's the story of Governor Morris and his wild-ass life.
That ending.
Right? I know. Sticking a whalebone up your dick. No big deal. Up your pee hole.
It was a long time ago, but...
Like, why are you doing this?
Doing your own medical procedures is a bad idea.
You're rich. You can hire a doctor.
Yeah.
So, I don't know. I kind of want to say that this guy is, like, my hero. He was, like, he was so fearless. He's just living his best life with a peg leg.
Yeah.
He's traveling all over the world, drinking and dancing and gossiping.
I just love that he had a diary and that he wrote everything down. What a gift to this world.
I know. Laying pipe all over the globe.
Yeah.
But of course, he also had some kind of, he had some shitty politics.
Of course. He is a man.
Exactly. Well, so that was, yes, the point I was just about to make. It goes to prove the point that you like to make, that our heroes, our founding fathers are just men. They're just men.
What did I say? You don't know these hoes or something? Totally. They're just men. The end.
Yeah.
End statement. Mm-hmm. They're not gods. They're not perfect. They are men.
Yeah.
This man stuck a whalebone up his pee hole. Like, literally. Come now. This man.
And died. That's how you die? After that life?
Yeah.
You led that. But like... What a perfect ending to that life.
Truly,
right?
Yeah. He died as he lived.
Yeah, exactly.
Mess. Doing weird shit.
Doing mess. He only got to live this way because he was rich.
Of course.
But like,
yeah.
Good Lord, what a fun life.
I'm still just blown away by the fact that he had a peg leg.
I know. It really is the icing on the cake.
His story would be wild without it,
yeah.
But like with it, it just adds so much color.
I know. That he's like running around having... all of the sex, laying pipe around the globe.
Just like, but also throwing his leg when he needed to.
Holding it up. Look at me, I lost my leg in the war. Like, everyone's like, oh.
Yes, you're one of us. One of us.
We accept you.
What is it?
Google gobble.
Google gobble. Na, 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 na. But our drinks are pretty much empty. Yeah. I have a little left, despite it being absolutely delicious. Uh-huh. And if I had a straw, this would be gone.
Mm-hmm.
America's history is juicy. We just add rum and brandy and peach.
Cognac.
Oh, God. Everything.
Black
A little
tea,
bit of tea, some lemon.
Oleosaccharum.
We're doing the most with this one.
Yes.
Thank you so much for listening to Beyond Reproach. This has been Stephanie Domingo.
And Tux Lerzel.
Thank you to Tim Clough, our editor, our sound engineer, our podfather. We could not do this without him.
Unpossible. But also, just a reminder, everyone, don't stick a whalebone up your pee hole.
PSA.
You heard it.
You heard it first, y'all. Okay?
You heard it her first. Okey-doke.
Amazing. Okay. Bye.
Bye.
Beyond Reproach is proudly recorded in Bushwick, Brooklyn, on land belonging to the Lenape Nation. Please note we are not historians. We are just a couple of drunks who never shut up and love history. Full list of all source information can be found in the show notes on our website. Please take a moment to rate, review, and subscribe. Written reviews are especially important. If you like us, please do one of two things. Leave us a review on Apple Podcasts, or send this episode to a friend, family member, or someone who you think would be into it. Make sure you follow us on Instagram because we post our cocktail recipes the Thursday before each full episode. Please drink along with us if you are not driving. We also have a shop on beyondreproachpod.com. Get your merch, brand yourselves. We have exclusive content on Patreon where you can directly support the production of our show.